Welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, news director at WCAI. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan. She's digital editor at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, Anne.
Morning, Sean.
Joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner, Jim Deruda of the New Bedford Standard Times, and Nelson Siegelman, editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's take a look at what's been happening in the news this week and some changes to how Cape Cod's two hospitals are handling psychiatric cases.
Right. It looks like there's going to be a shift from using an on-call staff of 11 people that include they call it the psychiatric assessment team, 11 social workers, psychologists, and licensed health counselors, and moving into an in-hospital staff that's going to be evaluating people in need of psychiatric help, possibly, in the emergency room, referring them to a doctor in the emergency room who would check, clear the person, and then the behavioral health department in the hospital would then determine how the treatment plan for patients.
So it sounds like now this nearly a dozen members of this psychiatric assessment team, you called it?
Right.
They're the ones that are called in 24 hours a day if there is a potential psychiatric or mental health or behavioral case.
Right.
And so what they're doing, I think they've hired some nurse practitioners who would actually be doing evaluations with medical doctors now in the emergency room. Is that what you're saying?
Right. They have hired three specialized nurse practitioners. One will be at Falmouth Hospital, covering 8 hours Monday through Friday. At Cape Cod Hospital, there's two of these new hires that will cover 16 hours Monday through Friday. And this has caused some the members of the psychiatric assessment team to say they're cutting services here. This is not a 24/7 operation. Mm. And already they've seen evaluations of patients slow down a bit. The hospital is saying that they're calling it an enhanced treatment plan, that it hasn't been finalized yet. They're still putting it together. But the current team and the Dennis police chief were concerned about whether this is a cut in treatment, and if these nurse practitioners are on Monday through Friday, what happens over the weekends? What happens at night?
Right. I think the team also runs a 24-hour phone hotline for folks, too. That was in the story as well. And that it sounds like that might be going away. And, of course, this all happens, to put it in some context, we have a real shortage of psychiatric services here on the Cape.
Right,
anyway.
That's true. And as I understand it, a lot of people coming to the emergency room have psychiatric issues. That's why they're there. There's been an increase in those types of patients. So the hospital is saying this is going to deliver service much more quickly. There's be somebody on staff there to handle it more quickly instead of having to call somebody mm-hmm. on the on-call list. It's not clear how they're going to handle the hours that these nurse practitioners aren't working. But the hospital spokesman said that the plan is still being developed. The current psychiatric assessment team says they're saying that their team is going to be disassembled by October 31st. Hospital is saying no, that's not true. But did offer some of the people on this assessment team said that if they want to apply for jobs at the hospital, we welcome them to do so.
Yeah, just reading that story, it sounds like some of the comments being given to the reporter were made via email. And just, you know how it is in journalism, people may not realize it's very difficult to ask questions and do follow-ups and get the full sense of a story if you're only dealing with someone who will speak to you via email. Back in the day, let's say about 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we used to pick up the phone or go actually talk to a person and have a conversation to learn, you know, the details of things.
Right. And there is that give and take. And I think with the advent of email and responding by email, it allows you to kind of control the story, but it also doesn't always help you understand completely what's going on. And so while so it's not clear to us at this point, well, how do you cover the hours when these nurse practitioners aren't available?
Right.
We'll have to see what happens.
And, of course, it's not always the spokespeople and the PR people and those folks and the marketing people who just want to do email. Sometimes there are reporters who only just want to do email, and which is a pretty poor habit. That happened in this case.
That's where we come in.
That's right. The editors. Get out there. Go do something. All right. Let's move on to this next story. We've been hearing a lot about former Congressman Bill Delahunt's efforts to open some medical marijuana facilities in the region. And he got some preliminary licenses, and then he didn't get the final licenses, right? And now we hear more news about the former congressman. Sounds like he's getting out of the medical marijuana business.
Right. Delahunt announced this week that he is stepping down from the medical marijuana of Massachusetts. He's part of the board, I believe president as well. And he had been approached by a group seeking to expand addiction treatment services in the Northeast, and he can't do both. So he is stepping down. Current CEO, Dr. Herlihy, said that this wasn't unexpected, and did comment about how the story about former Congressman Delahunt's involvement in this organization, and the appearance of favoritism, just dogged their
application.
Application process for the last few months.
What does he mean by that? Remind us some of the backstory. I remember when he submitted the application, not just him, but the organizations that he was heading up. There were some concerns about some statements that he attributed to
President Theresa Murray.
Right, saying that she had signed off on it in some way or
recommended
words to that effect. But then she comes out and said, well, we talked about it, but I didn't sign off or approve or anything else. So that was a problem. What else?
Well, just to remind everybody, last January there were 20 licenses that were issued by the state for medical marijuana clinics, and Delahunt's group got 3 of them. That caused a huge backlash. People were saying that there was favoritism, that Health Commissioner Cheryl Bartlett and Delahunt were friends. She'd even contributed to his campaign when he was a congressman at one point. And so that was number one backlash. And I think that's what Dr. Hurley, he was talking about.
Oh,
this part
okay.
of the story wouldn't die. So as that's going on, the 20 groups that got these licenses, excuse me, the groups that got the 20 licenses were then subjected to a deeper check, background check and other things. That's when even though the Therese Murray issue arose before this background check, the state folks said that they really were concerned about the business structure of Massachusetts medical marijuana of Massachusetts. That or the medical marijuana of Massachusetts is a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
However, they had a for-profit management company that would manage the nonprofit. There were concerns about how many profits from the nonprofit were then going back to the for-profit, and the fact that the boards were virtually identical of both operations. So was it really, you know, some might say it was a shell of a nonprofit representing a for-profit. My understanding is, and I don't know all the details, but that there have been some changes and adjustments made between the two different entities. The Medical Marijuana of Massachusetts also has filed a complaint with the state officials saying there's nothing in the law here that allows you to pull back a license once you have issued it.
Mm.
So that's where that stands at this point. And now we see former Congressman Delahunt stepping down from and getting out of this altogether.
And, of course, I think it was Medical Marijuana of Massachusetts, Delahunt's organization there, that was going to open one of the clinics or one of the locations in Mashpee, right?
Right.
But the Dennis one is still moving forward. That's a different organization.
Right. That's a different organization. That's the only one, as I recall, on the Cape at this point.
Right.
But the Medical Marijuana of Massachusetts got the Mashpee dispensary or a dispensary permission for a dispensary in Mashpee, Taunton, and Plymouth. And in fact, they've already started the cultivation center in Plymouth. They spent more than $1 million, according to Dr. Herlihy.
Wow.
And that's part of the reason they're making a complaint, because you told us we had this. We moved forward on that basis. We spent a lot of money. And so we'll see what happens. Maybe with Delahunt stepping out, it makes things easier to change. I mean, that's pure speculation on my point.
Okay. Let's talk about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, which we talk about quite often. We have a very active group here on the Cape and the islands who are concerned about if there was a problem at the aging plant, how Cape Codders would get off or visitors would get off of the peninsula or the island, depending on what you think we're living on here. And so now it sounds like the state's paying attention and there's some watchdog groups involved worried about trespassing. What are the issues this week? There are a couple different stories.
Right. The first thing that happened was that there was a first-of-its-kind working session between anti-nuclear activists from Cape Cod Downwinders or Downwinders of Cape Cod and a group in Duxbury called Pilgrim Watch to look at the real-time monitoring for radiological releases. These are real-time. They are monitoring the air constantly to see if there's any radiological emissions. Mm-hmm. If that would happen, they would sound an alarm and different, depending on the levels of emergency activation would occur. The Cape Cod Downwinders are saying that there's a hole in that system that virtually leaves Brewster to Chatham area to Provincetown uncovered by this monitoring system, that there's a hole in it. And so they met with Suzanne Condon, the director of the Bureau of Environmental Health for the state of Massachusetts and the Department of Public Health, and a team of other people with her, experts. And they said, in fact, they will check and see whether this is true, whether there are holes in its network system, and if there are, try to put monitoring systems in place, although they cost about $45,000 to put them in. So money is going to be a factor if the Cape is to get any of these monitoring systems.
And I believe Duxbury actually paid privately for its monitor. It wasn't the reactor or Entergy, the owner of the reactor, who paid for that. And there was some speculation that that might have to be the case. If the Cape wants some of those monitors, they would have to pay for them, either the communities or the county, somebody would have to pay for them. And of course, those are important if there is some release, whether it's been announced or not, whether they're aware or not, to know which way the radioactivity is blowing in the wind. So that's
exactly.
You can make some decisions about how you're going to evacuate, if you're going to evacuate.
And these monitoring systems also monitor the weather. So if there is a release, you can start predicting, okay, if the wind, we know which way the wind's going, who do we need to get out first if it's a major release? So the town of Duxbury did buy their own, but I understand the state has agreed now to take it over. And I want to correct myself. It was the Downwinders that met with Susan Condon.
They all work together,
yes,
both those groups.
Right.
They rely
many decades,
on each other.
Yes.
I know. Mary Lambert of the Duxbury group, she's turned herself into an attorney in order to fight the reactor.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Tim Wood's going to join us. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan, who is an editor at the Cape Cod Times, Cape Cod Online. She's the digital editor of the paper. And joining us on the phone is Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Tim. Let's talk about the Chatham Bar. Tell us what the Chatham Bar is and why it's a danger in its current configuration.
Well, the Chatham Bar is the series of sandbars that sit just outside the inlet into Chatham Harbor. This is right across from the lighthouse in Chatham. And for centuries, the Chatham Bar has kind of been infamous for being treacherous and a dangerous crossing that that boaters and fishermen especially have to make in order to get from the harbor to the outer waters. And the bar is changing all the time. It's moved. It moves constantly. It moves as the beach moves. It moves sort of on its own sometimes. And the dangerousness of it was proven again last week when a 40-foot fishing boat, its hold full of dogfish, ran into trouble crossing the bar. The fishing boat just hit the bar at the wrong time, wrong place, wrong time. Took a wave over the side and ended up getting swamped. And the Coast Guard and Harbor Master made it to the scene quickly, summoned by another fisherman who had just crossed the bar right before this safely. But the fisherman behind him, who was a guy named Bruce Kaminsky, a 30-year veteran of the fishing fleet here. He knows what he's doing, but he still got into trouble there. The Coast Guard were able to put a line on the boat and tow it out of the surf, and the harbor master got the captain safely off the boat. The vessel, called Never Enough, eventually was refloated, taken to Ryder's Cove, and hauled out, where it apparently didn't suffer too much damage.
Not much they can really do about it. I mean, these sands are going to continue to shift, right?
Well, that's the thing. There's nothing you can do about it. The harbor master marks the deep water channel as best he can, but he said it changes daily, so yeah. It's almost impossible to keep up with the changes. And fishermen and the Coast Guard have told me that recently that the bar has sort of narrowed and gone more parallel to South Beach, and that's made it more shallow. It's made it more difficult for fishermen to get over the bar. They have to sort of run parallel to the beach and then cross over this very short area where, you know, if they hit it at the wrong time, the wrong tide, they could bottom out easily. They could get a wave like happened last week. It's very difficult. The Coast Guard is out there constantly training on the bar so that they can respond like they did last week. But you're right, Dan. You're right, Sean. There's nothing we can do about this. You just have to watch it. Local knowledge rules in this case. If you don't know what you're doing, call the Coast Guard, call the Harbor Master, and ask them for advice or tell them you need help.
Okay, let's move on to another story. It looks like the Chatham Conservation Commission is heading into a conflict with the state.
Indeed. This past summer, the selectmen sort of did a clean sweep of the Conservation Commission. They removed two longstanding members, another member resigned, resulting in three fairly new members becoming a majority on the board. Last week, this majority voted to allow a property owner along Shore Road, this is just north of the fish pier here, to build a rock revetment to protect their bank, which they say is eroding. Now, what's controversial about this, there's plenty of revetments in Chatham. What's controversial about this one is that this homeowner had been before the commission previously, before this change, with the same plan, but had put it on hold when they realized that the earlier commission was not going to approve it. And the main reason they weren't going to approve it is that state wetlands regulations prohibit rock revetments to protect homes that were built after 1978. And this particular home was built, I believe, in the 1980s. Commission members also had previously said that they don't believe that their bank on this property is eroding at a high enough rate to justify a revetment, and that a revetment could starve the surrounding beaches of sand, which revetments tend to do, and cause other problems. But last week, the commission split sort of down new and old member lines, voted 3-2 to allow this. The commission members who voted to allow it said that they feel that homeowners should be allowed to protect their property, and this home is a valuable home. It's valued at more than $3.5 million. And their position basically was, let the state come down and tell us we can't do this. We think we should be able to do it. Let the state tell us.
Did you talk to the state at all?
Not at this point. They voted it, but they didn't finalize the paperwork, so it hasn't moved on to the state level yet. The state's not going to comment on something they haven't seen yet.
Sure.
But it's going to wind up on their desk, and that's going to set the conflict in motion, I think.
Right, and I would imagine that the town council would have to get involved in that. Then there could be money spent to defend a decision like that.
That's possible. If the commission decides to defend it, they may just leave it up to the homeowner to do that. What's interesting here is that there are two similar proposals by neighbors, which also had been on hold because they weren't going to be approved. We're watching very closely to see if they're going to refile with this new commission to see if they can get approval.
Okay, Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. He joins us each week here on the News Roundup, and you can follow Tim and the Cape Cod Chronicle newsroom on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Thank you very much, Tim. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean. Take care.
You too. And with me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan. Ann, we were talking about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, and there was another story that we didn't get to in our earlier conversation regarding security.
Right. This is a petition that was filed by the Cape Cod Downwinders and Pilgrim Watch saying that they need to increase security at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant or shut it down. They said that there's been 15 incidents of trespassing at the Plymouth Plant property since 2002, and this has been documented by news and or police reports. There were three trespassing incidents that happened in just the last month. There was a man and a woman from Connecticut who said that they were looking for the beach, and another pair were found, two men that were found on the property said they were looking for a place to fish. And there was also a case where members of the Downwinders were being interviewed by a news team from Boston, and they walked into the property, Pilgrim property, plant property, into a building, stayed a few minutes, and came out again with no one even stopping them. And what they're saying is that there's not enough security visible in the, you know, outer perimeter, mm-hmm. and with the threats of terror and other things, terror threats, that this isn't a good situation. Pilgrim Energy spokesman said that they do have a lot of security, that they have not made cuts to security, but that as you get closer to the reactor, the insecurity increases. So despite the fact that there's not a lot visible on the outer perimeter, there's a lot more on the inner perimeter. The Downwinders and Pilgrim Watch folks say, well, shouldn't we try to keep people as far away as possible? Because the closer you get, the easier it is to do more damage. The NRC has the petition and said that it would be referred to either the director of the Office of Nuclear Reactor Regulation or Nuclear Security and Incident Response. So we'll see what happens.
Okay. And let's go to the phone where Sally Rose is hanging on. She, of course, is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Sally.
Hi, Sean.
Sally, tell us about Provincetown's Coastal Resiliency Project.
Well, this is, of course, Sean, something that many coastal communities are seeing, high-risk areas where wind and waves and higher tides are increasingly eroding the shoreline. Communities are facing the need to create mitigating solutions that will, with any luck, allow the shoreline to adapt to these changing conditions. And Provincetown is calling this project, as you mentioned, the Coastal Resiliency Project, and it's going to be a year-long effort. For the project, the town received a $100,000 grant from the State Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs, and that was in July, and it will allow it to work on this, which the town will be doing in cooperation with Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies. And to start, they're going to hold two workshops. The first is coming up on Saturday, September 27th. That's in 1 week. And another will be held on October 3rd. Both of them will be basically covering the same material and will involve town officials, scientists from the Coastal Studies, and the town is hoping the public will turn out as well, and including waterfront property owners, to talk about the erosion and the effects of other natural phenomena on the shoreline and begin to start laying out possible options to try to protect the shore and, of course, the man-made structures along it from these effects. So they're holding the two workshops to try and attract as much input as possible from property owners and any other interested parties. And the plan is to have this project result in a beach management plan, a comprehensive plan, and also as part of that project and the grant, the study of sand movement from Wellfleet to Provincetown also will be done. So that should be really interesting.
Okay, sounds like an important process. What's happening on Saturday? Pam is having an auction. What's Pam, and tell us about it.
Right, Pam's holding its annual consignment auction, and this year, in honor of its centennial, of course, it will feature pretty much a history of Provincetown through the masterworks that are up for bid, and an exhibition of the artwork that's available in the auction has already been hanging in the Hans Hoffman Gallery at the Art Association and over the last several weeks, and it includes work by deceased artists from Provincetown's past, and that includes Bud Hopkins, Ross Moffitt, Judith Shawn, Nano de Groot, Albert Edel, Carl Nass, and more. And it should be interesting if you're available to do that and able to do that. And the bidding begins at 7 p.m. this Saturday.
Wow, some big names there. If you're looking to start an art collection or keep it moving forward, that sounds like a good thing to attend.
Exactly.
Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner, and she joins us here on the Roundup each week. Sally, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay, and with me, of course, is Anne Brennan from the Cape Cod Times. Anne, let's talk about plovers or plovers, whatever you prefer, the little migrating birds that are protected, and so much work goes into protecting their nests here on the Cape and the islands, and that means not allowing off-road vehicles to get too close to those nests during breeding season. But what is happening now? I think these permits that they sell to allow people to use these off-road vehicles and go for big bucks, and then what happens often is beaches get closed down and the permit holders can't actually use them. And so selectmen are always looking for ways to kind of make things work better for everybody.
Right. So what the selectmen are doing is that they accepted a plan for our piping plovers on the southern end of Nauset Beach that will now be forwarded to the U.S. Fish and Wild Service to see if they can get a permit to allow vehicles to traverse the beach in a specific corridor that would be determined every day based on where the plovers are. And this would be from 8 to 10 a.m. in the morning and 4 to 6 in the evening. This escort plan would allow up to 180 vehicles to drive along a plover-free beach corridor. And it would be just under half a mile, and with a maximum width of 30 feet. And under this plan, each vehicle would have a vehicle monitor, someone who is 16 or older that would walk in front of the vehicle, about 5 feet in front of the vehicle, to see if there's any plover in the way. This corridor could be shut down because there will be monitors hired to see where the plover broods are, and if one of them starts to cross the corridor, they can shut the corridor down. But it's a way to allow this corridor to stay open. As you said, there's money involved for the town. In 2013, there was the longest recorded shutdown of 83 consecutive days of off-road driving on the beach, and it took a hit, a 33% drop in revenue from about $320,000 to $213,000 for the year. So $320,000 is what they had earned in 2007. So there's a financial thing. There's also, you want to protect the brood, and you can put things in place to do that while allowing people to use the beach. So they're hoping that the U.S. Fisheries and Wildlife Service will issue the permit. The state has already approved the similar plan, and the town expects to hear in about 3 to 4 months.
Okay. Let's go back to the phone where Jim DeRuta is waiting. He is the editorial page editor at the New Bedford Standard Times and SouthCoastToday.com. Welcome to The Point, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. Let's talk about the new bishop who is arriving for the Catholic Diocese of Fall River. Sounds like a well-respected gentleman.
I think so. And, he was appointed by Pope Francis, and they're both South Americans. The new bishop, Edgar da Cunha, is of Brazil. So they're both South Americans, and they both seem to be cut from the same cloth. Bishop da Cunha, he's already an auxiliary bishop in Newark, New Jersey, so he's already attained that station. But he has spent a lot of time fighting for justice for immigrants in Newark, trying to repair the relations between the police and undocumented workers. He has said that people are looking for answers in this world, and that wealth is not generally the source of those answers. He's coming with a very populist message, very similar to Francis's.
Okay, and Brennan has a question for you, Jim.
I agree, Jim. The Pope Francis is much more focused on social justice and kind of getting away from specific issues such as abortion and other things that were the focus, and really wants to be in the company of people instead of kind of ruling from on high. He's really instructing you know, Catholic priests and bishops to get out among the people and start working with people, especially in the social justice realm.
Yes, Bishop DiCunha is right in line with that. One of the priests in New Bedford had said that from all accounts, something like this, from all accounts, the Holy Spirit and the Pope have sent us a true shepherd of souls.
And, of course, the Fall River in New Bedford for many years attracted a lot of people from Portugal, but now there's a lot of large influx of South Americans and Central Americans, and it would seem like this is a bishop who speaks their language, and of course that's a population that relies heavily on the church for everything from social interactions to support. So it sounds like an important position.
There's also one of the things that's been happening, and especially in Brazil, is a movement to the more evangelical religions.
Yeah.
And so this might be another way to address and try and get some people back to the Catholic Church.
Maybe. Jim, any final thoughts on this story? You want to move to the next one?
Well, yes. He has spoken to say that evangelism is going to be an important aspect of his ministry here. And one more reminder is that the Cape and Islands are included in the Fall River Diocese.
That's right. There's a small athletic shoe business in town. They have two shops, one in Fall River and one in New Bedford. Now it sounds like this small store is going up against Nike.
That's who they're going up against. It's a family-owned business. And on the back of their invoices is some fine print that says they can stop selling the top-line shoes to anybody they want, anytime they want.
Nike can.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's what they've done to Carter's. And Carter's is trying to argue that, saying that, you know, something in small print on the back of an invoice does not constitute a negotiated contract. So they filed a suit against Nike, and it was struck down because that clause says that you can't bring anything against Nike unless you bring it in their home state of Oregon, which is a little challenge for a little business.
Right. And so, and this little business, Nike makes up, what, 30% of their sales?
That's right.
Any indication why Nike doesn't want to deal with this business anymore?
Nobody really knows. Nike won't say. They're assuming it has to do with trying to focus their marketing in the malls rather than outside of the malls and in the communities. Hmm. I'm not sure why they wouldn't want as many outlets as possible, but that's what they've decided. It's the top line that they're withholding from Carter's.
Okay. Oh, the top line.
Like Air Jordan, $150 sneakers.
I see. Huh. Okay, we'll continue to watch that story. Jim Deruta is the editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard-Times, and you can follow the page on Twitter at OpinionSCT. And there was another good story in the paper we didn't quite get to this week about solar panel installation that Bristol Community College is handling for some parking lots. So you can go and read about that if you're interested in the solar push here in the state. Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Ann.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I expect to talk to Nelson Siegelman, the Martha's Vineyard Times editor. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI. We're discussing the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. I'm the news editor here at WCAI, or news director. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan. She's the digital editor at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. And Ann, let's talk about this roadside display. We had a conversation about this last week here on the Roundup. I got a little worked up, but I'm not going to this week. This is a display we're talking about. It's on the corner of Route 28 and Old Stage Road in Centerville. Tell us about it.
Right. Steve Luciani, who owns Cape Light Carpets, which is right near this intersection, has been putting up decorations on that corner for 20 years. And this summer, he put up something that it was a beach scene, and there was a letter to the Cape Cod Times saying objecting to it because it's right next to a cemetery, and it's unclear to me how, but the state highway officials found out about this, said that it, you know, legally you can't put stuff up on a state highway like that, and asked him to take it down. He had like 2 weeks to take it down. So when this got out into the public, people really got angry and really started letting officials know that, you know, this is ridiculous. There's a Facebook page with over 3,300 likes. There's a change.org petition that has more than 1,200 signatures. The Representative Brian Mannell, who he's a state legislator for that area, got involved, and there was going to be a meeting between Steve Luciani, Mannell, and the highway officials this week. But it turns out that the maps that the state has that determines whether this is state property or town property, there's maps don't agree with each other. So they had to go out and do a new survey of this intersection to determine who owns the property. And once that is determined, it'll take a few weeks. There'll probably be a meeting. But according to the director of the DPW in Barnstable, Daniel Santos, he thinks the property does belong to the state. And if that's the case, there may be a movement to try and retake that property, annex it into the town, see if the state legislature would make it town property. And at that point, it might be able, Luciani's might be able to fall into the Adopt a Spot program that the town has, mainly for beautification. So we'll see what's going to happen.
Okay. Let's talk about Chatham. Let's move back to Chatham to talk about South Beach. And voters in Chatham are concerned that there is a push by the feds, the U.S. Fisheries and Wildlife Service, to actually take a part of that beach. They're calling it a land grab or what have you, and Chatham voters want to fight it.
Right. Talk about people getting angry. The Fisheries and Wildlife Service draft comprehensive management plan for Monomoy, as you say, calls for taking 717 acres of South Beach, or at least saying that this is federal property, park property, not town property. And that's really made people upset, as well as the limits that they're going to put on who fishes in the area, what kind of fish.
That's what it's really coming down to, right?
And what kind of gear you can use within park boundaries, including waters off its shoreline. So at a special town meeting this week, voters okayed $300,000 to hire a consultant and or lawyer to fight this. And the Chatham has until October 10th to submit comments on the plan. And so they are going to fight this.
What did you say? It was 717 acres. And this came as a big surprise to the town. They get this management plan and suddenly, wait, we're losing almost, you know, more than 700 acres here to the federal government?
Right, it was. It was a complete surprise. And like you say, the fishing issues, you know, shell fishing has been going on in that area and offshore for a long, long time. And now it's going to be regulated when it never had been.
Right. Right. And, well, who knows what those regulations would be, but typically the federal government's pretty strict with those types of things.
It definitely goes out of local control.
Yes.
You know, usually towns can control the shellfish beds in their town without intervention.
Right. I wonder why the federal government even wants to deal with that area.
I can't remember, but I think I think it has to do with shifting sands, and that, there's new property as the sand shift in that area. That's why they're saying it now becomes part of Monomoy.
I see. Okay. Right. That makes sense. Let's talk about Sandwich. So for a while now, some residents in Sandwich right around along Route 6 have been fighting a natural gas pipeline, high-pressure pipeline there. And they didn't win that fight. It looks like that pipeline's going in.
Right. The pipeline is actually 13 miles, and about 4 miles of it goes through Sandwich. It's going to go along this service road. And neighbors in the area were very upset about this because of safety issues. They worry about a high-pressure gas line, as well as a plan to cut down hundreds of trees that stand between Service Road and Route 6. So it's a barrier for residents who live along the Service Road. And when you cut down trees in Sandwich, according to town bylaw, the requirement is that you have to replace what is taken away. You need a detailed plan about what you're going to replace it with. This week, National Grid released a mitigation plan for the trees that they're going to take down, and said that we will be replacing these trees. It's not a very detailed plan, but it entails replacing trees with trees that are like the trunk is about 2.5 inches, as opposed to there's some big trees in that area, and evergreens that would be about 8 feet tall. There would be shrubs as well. But Randy Hunt, the state legislator who represents Sandwich, says this is an indication that National Grid is trying to work with us. There's neighbors who were saying this isn't enough. This is really going to be a big impact on the area. There's a Board of Selectmen meeting at 7 p.m. in Town Hall on September 25th to give the plan a thumbs up or thumbs down. But as Bud Dunham, the town administrator, said, that the town is kind of at a disadvantage because if they try to sue in court to stop this this pipeline once it's been approved by the state, usually the town loses or the entity loses.
Oh, sure.
The utilities always win. But the other kind of fly in the ointment is that the town said they did not want the road used for the pipeline, which would have been the traditional place to put it, would have been under the road.
Okay.
They asked that it be on the side of the road because they were afraid that the pipeline might interfere with the water pipes and hydrant system in the road. So the siting board, the state siting board, mentioned this in their decision that you asked for it not to be in the road, so
don't complain about the trees.
Right. And
all right.
So we'll see what happens. I'm sure that meeting's going to be a lot of people are going to attend that meeting.
Understand the neighbors wanting trees as that important buffer between them and Route 6 there. I can understand that. Nelson Siegelman is on the phone, of course, and he is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
So the businesses in town are on the island. They're investing in tighter security. What, there's been more shoplifting?
Well, I don't know if it's more shoplifting. Shoplifting has been a problem, I think, on Martha's Vineyard and every summer community, every normal community, really. We see a spike often in the summertime, and in a story in this week's Times by Steve Myrick, he spoke with some local merchants about what they've been doing to combat the problem. And a lot of it has to do with tighter surveillance, security cameras, and just keeping an eye on folks. But certainly the people are ingenious in the ways they often will try to steal. We had a police officer tell us just the last week about a very expensive pair of sunglasses that someone was looking at, put down on the counter. The merchant wasn't looking, and the person picked them up and walked out with them. And, you know, these things are small items, but they're really expensive. I mean, a pair of nice sunglasses can go for $200 or $300. So that's a that's a big hit to somebody's profit margin on a daily basis.
Right. And, of course, anecdotally across the region, we have been hearing, yes, increases in petty thefts and shoplifting. Those are often crimes that people who are addicted to drugs will go out and perpetrate, to use the police officer's language there.
Well, you know, it can be just kids, too, or that
yep.
sort of thing. I guess the one thing I'd mention is although the penalties may not be that severe, certainly on Martha's Vineyard, you end up in our court report, and that court report then becomes part of your record on online now, you know, so many of these things. If you end up in even a small story, you know, 10, 15 years ago is a half inch, an inch of type. Nobody saw it outside that immediate community. Now that sort of thing can follow you wherever you go.
Oh, you make a good point. So the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries and the Department of Public Health had closed Ketama Bay to harvesting oysters, but now it's back open. What was the issue there?
Well, yes, and this isn't anything new, and it's happened in oyster farms or around the state, but there were four illnesses that were traced back, they think, to oysters that came from Ketama oyster farms, and that state regulators working with the Department of Public Health closed down the harvest for 1 week. Basically, it was a precautionary closure because they're concerned that with the warm water that might lend itself to this bacteria, which is called Vibrio. And as a result, the farms were still operating. They just couldn't harvest. But that was a week closure, and they reopened them. And people once again enjoying Ketama oysters, thank goodness, because they are pretty tasty.
Okay. Nelson Sigelman is the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Nelson, thank you for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Okay. And with me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan, the digital editor at the Cape Cod Times. Ann, I know we were going to talk about the new town administrator in the town of Truro, and I encourage people to go to the Cape Cod Online, I guess is the website there, right?
Yes.
To see that story. Let's talk about the other story from the Sunday paper. This mother wants to know why, how her son died in the county jail.
Right. Ellen Shannon, whose son John Shannon died on his 31st birthday back on May 23rd, while he was in waiting for sentencing on a assault-related charges. He was at the Barnstable County Correctional Facility at the time of his death, and she's looking for answers. Shortly after her son was found unresponsive, a day or two, the DA released information that opiates were found in John Shannon's urine, and that's about all she knows at this point. The Barnstable County Sheriff James Cummings says that this is under investigation, and Ellen Shannon even filed a public records request to see if she could see what was going on in this investigation, but under state law, ongoing investigations are exempt from public records requests, so it's not public at this point. But the reason why it was denied was in the letter, the response said that the Cape and Islands District Attorney is looking to indict Mr. Shannon's cellmate on manslaughter charges in Mr. Shannon's death. So there is an assumption, I guess, at this point, or they're trying to prove that this cellmate, who has not been identified, may have carried drugs in with him when he was brought to the jail. He did tell the prison officials or jail officials that he had snorted some heroin prior to coming into the jail, and that he had some heroin kept the heroin in his right pocket. A dog at the jail did smell some heroin on that particular pocket and his hand, but there was no other evidence of this inmate having any drugs.
Huh.
They're wondering if maybe he carried it in a body,
inside himself.
Yeah.
So John Shannon, the young man who died in jail, what he was in jail for?
He had been convicted or pleaded guilty to some assault charges and was waiting for sentencing.
Because it sounded, from reading what his mother had to say, that it sounded like he wasn't a heroin addict.
Right.
Maybe she wouldn't have been aware that he was. Who knows?
Right. Well, he had been diagnosed with a schizophrenic-type mental health issues.
Some issues, yeah.
So he had been in and out of trouble with the police. He did have mental health issues. Those were documented. And she was saying that she had never known him to use heroin that she knew of, or that he was against it.
Well, it's a very interesting story, and the investigation continues. Thank you, Anne Brennan, digital editor at the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com. Thanks for coming into our Woods Hole studio today.
Thank you, John.
And you can follow Anne on Twitter at Anne Brennan, CCT. And thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. They all joined us here on the News Roundup. I'm Sean Corcoran. You can follow me on Twitter if you like, at Corcoran, WCAI. Thank you for listening.
The Friday News Roundup on The Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.